Pacte has been managed privately since its founding in 1805, meaning that our partners have dealt with the same challenges facing all entrepreneurs. Our owner-managers are themselves entrepreneurs who, like our clients, want to build an even stronger firm to pass on to the next generation. Over more than 200 years, we have built up experience and specialist wealth management expertise that puts us in an ideal position to offer independent advice. Entrepreneurial clients feel a deep connection with our partners as they can speak with them on the same level, business owner to business owner.
The way we work and where we work are huge topics of discussion for employers around the world, and something which has been pounced upon by the operators of now ubiquitous co-working spaces. In London, just like members' clubs, they are a dime a dozen, with everyone promising nice coffee and reliable Wi-Fi. Hotels and retailers are even jumping on board, trying to create the space where you're going to spend your time and money. And thankfully, there are a number of companies thinking deeply about how space impacts our productivity and well-being, and doing more to create engagement and community for their members. Uncommon is one of those places, a company which uses research and design in space, sound, scent, and lighting to create the ideal environment. And all of the design is done by the company's co-founder and CEO, the former lawyer and residential property developer, Tanya Adir. Tanya started her career working at a top international law firm, Allen & Overy, before launching the property development firm G&T London with her husband, Gal. On the backs of their massive success in residential real estate, they saw an opportunity in converting commercial space, and specifically in the demand for well-designed shared spaces, launching Uncommon back in 2014. While she says she's not creative by nature, Tanya has overseen the design of Uncommon's properties in Borough, Fulham, Highbury, and Islington, and a property on Liverpool Street that opened earlier this year covering 8 floors and including more than 1,000 plants. You're listening to The Entrepreneurs with me, Daniel Bage. For this week's episode, I sat down with Tanya at Midori House to talk about her career to date, plans for a new location and international expansion, and the purpose in design behind Uncommon.
I went to university to study law, and I thought that was a sort of a really good grounding degree to have. And unfortunately for me, that's probably came to one of the hardest times, really, in the recession. So Lehman Brothers was collapsing as I was applying for my training contract in the biggest law firms in the world. So for me, it was kind of a really golden opportunity that I managed to strike a contract with the largest law firm, Allen & Overy. I was incredibly happy, was very excited. But actually, when it came to actual work and what I did, I found that I enjoy the academic aspect of it. I really enjoy the sort of theoretical aspect of it. Practical aspect wasn't as appealing as it kind of sounded. It was very much a young graduate who was sort of looking, work hard, play hard, big corporate, very kind of dazzling city, you know, impression that all these big corporates make. But actually, when you're on the inside, you realize, well, it's not as amazing. And I think the tangibility was very much something that I was missing. I was part of massive transactions. We're talking kind of billions of pounds and dollars of bond issues and documents, but it was all about paper. And there wasn't really that human element factor, nothing that I could kind of touch and feel. There wasn't really a person behind that deal. It was corporates and conglomerates. And I think that's what I kind of really missed when I was there. I always was attracted to property. I don't know, it is from early age real estate and bricks and mortar. There was some appeal. There was some appeal to design. And at the time, myself and my husband, we bought our first flat. We managed to get on a property ladder just after the crunch when there was a good time in the market to actually buy real estate. And we sort of thought, well, actually, maybe it's, you know, something we should be doing more on a side, away from the sort of day-to-day job as a kind of, you know, it wasn't really a business idea at the time. We just sort of thought, okay, let's invest in property. Let's see if we can make something out of it. We fundraised from friends and family. It was very much kind of a, you know, little bit of money from close people to us. And we got into it. We refurbished the first flat. We sold it. And we realized, wow, you know, not only that it's actually making money, but it's a very fun, exciting, tangible thing to do because we took this dilapidated flat in Lancaster Gate, which was kind of 30 years unrefurbished, and made something really nice out of it. We lived there for a little bit, and then at some point we thought, well, actually, it makes a lot more sense financially and so much more satisfying. And that was probably kind of a turning point where we thought, well, it just makes more sense. And I guess being quite young, I mean, we both were, I think I was 21 or 22. He was also, so he's a year older than I am. Maybe the older you get, the more apprehensive you get, but younger you are, a little bit more kind of risk-taking. So we kind of thought, actually, you know, let's try. I was first looking after the business full-time. Then I actually went to train with Alan Novery for a couple of years. That's when he left. He was at Investec, property, real estate, finance. He left there and then he took over kind of looking at it full-time. And then at the end of September 2014, that's when actually I came on board full-time. It was kind of testing the water carefully, but at the same time also completing my career, getting my qualification. I was sort of feeling, you know, at least I finished what I started. I get my certification. If anything happens in life, you can always go back. But I was 100% sure this is not what I want to do full time. So it was, while it was a really exciting moment for my early 20s to think, okay, become a lawyer, become a partner in a big city law firm, realizing that actually it's not as amazing, and proving yourself that, you know, there's something else you can do out there and step away from it and make it a lot more creative longer down the line.
That's really interesting. And I'm sure a lot of people listening to this are going to say, oh, why didn't I think about that? Getting friends and family to invest a little bit in setting you up so you have a firm platform with some investments and owning some property. But also, at the same time, you're able to contrast with your husband and work a little bit, keep one foot in that professional world, but also set out on your own. That's a fascinating way to do it and to set yourself up. But I'm also curious about how you were so sure early on in going into law that you wanted to do something else, because we don't need to dwell on age all the time, but 21 is pretty young to have that idea that you wanted to do something different.
It was inertia in a way that you just got attracted to something that appealed to you, but I think you don't know until you try. And I do have a lot of friends that stayed behind in law, continued on the path, and they kind of always wondered, what else can I do? You know, I would love to try something else, but they don't know. And I think it's that maybe courage to some extent and maybe just risk-taking of trying something else, because you don't know what you can be good at until you try. And I realized I never thought I'm creative in any way at all. I always thought I'm quite academic and a very sort of purpose-driven and, you know, it's all about studying, but not really the creative aspect of it. And through the property refurbishment and design work, and I kind of stepped in and did quite a bit of, I guess, architectural interior design work, I realized I can do many, many things that I've never thought I could do before. And then, you know, winning various different awards and being nominated was a revelation to me, because I'm not a trained designer, I'm not a trained architect in any way, shape or form. But we've managed through our work to create spaces that have been recognized and acknowledged by people that work in the industry, which is very humbling in a way. But at the same time, people ask, how do you do it? I'm not sure. It's just something that kind of works in my head and things that you put together. So a certain skill that I guess I discovered, or passionate as well as ability, you don't actually get to know whether you can be good at something unless you try. I think that was the kind of the key aspect of that journey. But that was just the beginning of it. And I think it was a nice start. But as with any business, there's always ups and downs. And we've managed to go through a phase where residential property was fantastic. It was, you know, very much at the top of the sort of 2012, 2014. But then, with Brexit and changes in SDLTs and changes in kind of how London appeals to the rest of the world, we've got into interposition, and that's actually where Uncommon was kind of set out off, which was unfortunate. I'll talk a little bit more about it. But I think it's also having the business acumen to apply to it and learn, and how that actually works within the context of a business, creative, but also something that makes financial sense, if you'd like, from kind of business point of view.
That is absolutely fascinating. And I'd love to jump into Uncommon here, and just the timing, because around this time is where the sort of co-working and creative spaces were really becoming popular. And that sounds like about the same time when you were starting to think about something different, not only in developing the property, but then you came on to the next idea. So tell us about that. Tell us about how you then went on to start Uncommon.
It was by sheer accident. We were really, really attracted to the sector. We were ourselves sat, myself and my husband, and we had one person that was a project manager. Three of us, we sat at Headspace, actually. It was one of the early kind of entrants to the London market around Clerkenwell area, so Farringdon area. And we sort of thought, well, it's a great idea. It would work really, really well. But, you know, we were so busy in the residential side that it wasn't really leaving us much time to kind of focus on anything else. And then we agreed to buy a building in Highbury in Islington. It was an office building, dilapidated office building, which was meant to be subject to planning permission, permitted development rights, which is sort of technical from kind of development aspect point of view. But in essence, you can convert an office building without really planning permission into residential. And residential at the time was worth a lot more than an office building would. However, Islington Council at the time, they're not quite keen to lose office supply as such, just because it changes the dynamics of the area and can impact on local residents. So they were very, very harsh in kind of not letting us do what we thought was the right thing to do. They probably were right in the first place, actually, but we didn't quite realise it at the time. So we got the refusal to do the changeover, ended up with a pretty much dilapidated building. It was about 20,000 square feet, middle of Highbury and Islington, no tenants whatsoever. And we were like, whoa, whoa, what are we going to do with it? Mm-hmm. And to be honest, we didn't really have a choice. We approached the guys we sat at in the offices in Farringdon. We said to them, look, we have this building. Would you like to come in and operate and run it as a co-working? And they said, you guys are absolutely smoking it. I mean, it's an area that nobody wants to be in from office point of view. It's not going to work. And it's a bit too big as well. And we didn't really have much choice. We kind of said, okay, we just have to do it one way or the other. And it was sort of scraping the last saving accounts that we had and putting all the cash in. And to be honest, we had good partners. We had a builder who we worked with for some time. And they kind of helped us with, you know, getting the cash flow and just refurbishing the space quite basically. It was very much OSB heaven. You would cover OSB and everything was cheap, cheerful, and to be honest, it's a very durable material, as we realised later on. It's actually pretty fun. We got the keys in November. By about January, we were open across three floors. So that was about 60-70% of the space. And by August, we were full. So it took us about 6 to 9 months to get full. And we were charging rates which you would never have thought you can ever achieve in that area. And people were loving it. And literally, we got to 90%. We realized, wow, not only that it's a great cash-flowing business, but it's just fun to run, as opposed to Resi. Resi is fantastic from the point of design point of view, but then once you develop, you sell it, you never see it again. You get this excitement from anyone who buys it and from the buyer when you know it's your buyer, that they really love what you've done. But after that, you don't really see it. With co-working, it's just something that you see every single day. You create a space and you see people enjoy it. They love the interaction, the community aspect of it, the element that, you know, we all have our daily grinds, and yes, we can be up, but we can also be down, and people see each other, know each other, grow together. And that was really a turning point when we realized, wow, actually, it's a fantastic business to have. And that was end of 2014, beginning of 2015. So WeWork wasn't really known at all at the time in London, at least as much. They've just opened their first asset in South Bank. So it was very early on in the pipeline. But what we've realized is actually we want to take a different trajectory. We don't want to go on the leasing route because we don't believe leasing route is a sustainable long term. We want to be on an ownership model. And that's really kind of how it all pivoted our way of thinking of, you know, where we're going to go next. We then had actually a friend of ours who was working for a big real estate investment fund who came around and he said, I love what you guys done here. Why can't I just invite my boss for him to see? Which he did. And we basically got onto the last stage of the investment committee of literally one of the largest property funds in the country. They said no to us, which we were incredibly upset in terms of kind of investment and enrolling the platform. But that was the beginning in our confidence that, well, if these guys looked at us, there must be some other people that would be interested. Okay, let's step away from Resi. Let's look into commercial. The funding round was, you know, we printed out the piece of paper of, you know, the largest private equity firms out there. And we kind of just started approaching one, every single one by one. And we had a good traction, regardless that it was very much at the beginning of our journey. And it was just one asset. You know, we've just been operating for about 12 months. We had a very, very positive response as a kind of a, you know, final result of that effort, which took us 9 to 12 months. And that kind of round, we managed to secure funding from one of the largest private equity houses in the world, the Carlyle Group, at the end of 2016. And that's kind of where the sort of the platform really took off.
You mentioned earlier about some of the deals that you were involved in when you were starting in law. Do you think that gave you the confidence in chasing this investment in saying, let's print out a sheet of all the biggest private equity firms and VCs and just go get it, just get it done? Were you confident as well that it was going to work out?
We didn't have anything to lose. I didn't have anything to lose. I think when I was doing and I was working at the, you know, and when I was quite disheartened about the whole aspect of that work, I didn't realize how useful that actually was to my personal learning and growth and development and understanding, and certain things that you just take for granted. I think that it's everyone's common knowledge. Everyone knows that. But actually, no, it's been sort of acquired throughout the years and of studying and then working for a firm. I think it certainly gives confidence to me that I can do it because I've worked for a big corporate and I've done a really good job at securing that contract in the first place in the very, very hard financial times. But also, when you meet people, I think they always try to benchmark you. You know, where are you from? What are you doing? Kind of where you worked. Okay, you worked here. It means you're not the crazy person. You probably are. Okay, fine. Let's have a conversation. I think that's a natural human way of how people interact. They always try to kind of benchmark you where you are. I think it helps. It's a great foundation. And it certainly helped me later when we're doing all the legal documentation throughout the whole journey of Uncommon. It's just intrinsic understanding of many different aspects of how business works and how property works and how law works that I never appreciated how useful it would have been when I was back in times of training contract and hours of, you know, 8 till 2 a.m. in the morning, and you kind of don't really want to think about the bigger picture. You're just in the grind day in, day out. But yes, it certainly is useful. I think I would certainly go back. I can't believe I'm saying that, but I would have done that again if I had a choice in terms of the training and the kind of the base that they've helped me get from those couple of years with them.
Is it scary then when you're looking at the next thing and not trying to grow too big? Because we've talked about scale already, and I mean, you're growing quite quickly now. I think this past spring you opened a flagship property on Liverpool Street, which covers 8 floors, I think. And I believe there's 4 properties in total now.
And we're just about to launch our new project, which is doubling the amount of space we have at the moment, which is a central Holborn location, which is going to be very much the flagship for us. So yes, we're growing very quickly and we're very much looking to expand on the continent and the kind of key gateway hubs around the world.
Tell me a little bit about the industry now. You've grown to have these 4, soon to be 5 properties now in a world where there are many, many co-working spaces, and the hotels as well and hospitality are trying to get into that same model by making their properties more attractive for people to spend more time in, spend their days in, more flexible offices, more flexible ways of working. More startups and companies are thinking about how they operate and how their staff works. So tell me about the world that you exist in and how and where you see that going.
It's changing, and it has been changing tremendously. Where we were 5 years ago in 2014-15, where we are now, it's like 2 entirely different worlds. The supply and the price offering and the options out there have gone from pretty much nothing to a massive array. And we're talking about London specifically, London being ahead of the game across the world. And I personally believe it's ahead of cities like New York. We have loads of different offers for all sorts of different sizes and budgets and tastes. And what it means for the operator is that you have to become more and more competitive in your offering, in the type of service you provide, in the type of fit-out that you provide, everything associated with the client's demands that have within, you know, your infrastructure, your internal processes, systems, your economies of scale. Because what we see at the moment is smaller co-working spaces, they are really going out of business fundamentally because they can't compete. They don't necessarily make the money. And it's very difficult for them to compete on the kind of a, you know, larger operator scale. So we see those sort of disappearing with larger operators becoming even larger and taking even more space. So it's fundamentally, you know, it's a very much a quickly maturing market. We're seeing a lot of operators coming into the space, but fundamentally, it's still a very fragmented market. So what we see is, I think there is about 1,300 centres in London. And if you look at kind of a landscape, the top 10 operators operate 70% of that space. And the rest operate the rest. So in essence, there is pretty much one center per operator a second you step out of those top 10. So there's a lot of sort of smaller players, and that creates a lot of noise in a way because everyone says, well, it's too hot, there's too many entrants to the market. But fundamentally, there's very, very few that really sit in that kind of large, we're talking sort of above 30,000, 40,000 square feet space. The issue with small operators, we find, is lack of amenities and facilities, and the price advantage that they can offer is just not there, because you still need to employ staff. You still need to do your, you know, fiber optic internet, which costs, doesn't matter whether you're in a small office or bigger office. So the infrastructure that you have to set up to run a co-working space is becoming a lot more serious. If before people used to think, well, it's just a person, you know, at the reception and a couple of plants and that's about it, and maybe it's, you know, some fancy coffee, no longer is that the case. You know, it's a lot about customer centricity. It's knowing your customers by name. It's knowing what coffee they like. It's knowing how their dog is doing and what sort of pitch and how it's been going their last fundraising. So it's being very, very customer-centric and customer-focused. And that impacts on how our own team feels, how they all perform, how they all feel about the space and about their work that they do. It's a very fast-moving industry. And I think it's just a matter of time until we see quite a bit of consolidation where smaller players will be acquired by larger ones and potentially some mergers between the larger ones also.
Well, that's very interesting. But I want to come on to just your purpose in design. As you say, there are, you know, a dime a dozen places, and some may think all you need is nice coffee and a few plants, as you say, and good Wi-Fi. But tell me a little bit about the design, because you've actually tried to think about this scientifically, in a sense, in a way that you create a calming, inspiring, interesting place to be and to exist. So tell me a little bit about that.
One aspect of being very much design driven is a big USP for Uncommon. And we've started from sort of very high level research and then actually ended up doing quite a bit of studies and working with professionals in the fields to understand exactly what helps us being productive. And the physical environment that we're surrounded in impacts massively on how we feel as human beings. We're saying 30 minutes being more productive every day saves about 3 working weeks a year. So imagine if you didn't have to work for 3 more weeks and you could go on holiday, or you could create something amazing in those 3 weeks a year. So it's the impact that the productivity has on how businesses are doing and on a global scale of human capital that is being just lost because the space is just inefficient and distracting and not inspiring. We've sort of invested quite a bit in trying various different ways of how space can help being productive. And that usually ranges between kind of a key core activities that one undertakes. Nobody sort of has just one type of task they do all day, every day. I mean, some people do, but majority have a variation of different tasks. It can be speaking with a colleague about something project related. It can be Excel spreadsheet where you have to put your head down and have to be very, very focused. And some other aspects like teamwork, creating spaces that encourage it and help with it. And that can start from lighting and the type of and the level of lux and the warmth of light, color scheme around it. You know, what colors are you surrounded by? And there is a lot of studies that have been done. For example, a more confined space with darker walls actually create a lot more sort of feeling of openness between people. When people sit, for example, on the lower chairs, on a lower level, it makes them feel a lot more open. While, for example, if you enter into a space with very high ceilings, it makes you feel quite intimidated, gives you a feeling of your insignificance to some extent. And there is a reasons why things like cathedrals, for example, or big courts and, you know, always been built in a very grand way, because it was intended to make maybe people feel a little bit more subdued and not as important. That all kind of runs through the psyche that we have. So smells is a massive one. They've conducted a study where a group of people was taken through a space, a corridor, which was exactly the same. And the first group, they've been given a scent in the air of a very nice smell. And the second one, it was kind of inconsistent and was sort of all over the place. The first group came out of this experiment and said that the space was clean and very tidy and very appealing. And the second group said the space was actually quite dirty and really uninviting. And the only difference that was there was just the smell. And that's the impact subconsciously that various different things have on our brain, how we perceive that space. It's the music, level of music, how fast it is, the heartbeat that actually mirrors the beat of the music. So a lot of times if you're on a treadmill and you're running and you have a very, very fast music, it's actually quite dangerous, what they say, because it makes your heart beat even faster. Lyrics or no lyrics, you know, how the music and the tonality of it, many different aspects to that design. And again, generational change, for example, if you're a generation millennial, you come into the space, the best number of seating position options is between sort of 6 to 8. But if you're from sort of baby boomers generation, actually you have to be below 6. And if you are sort of 6 to 8, you start feeling a bit confused and it's not the space that appeals to you naturally. So there is generational aspects of it as well. And there's so much psychology that goes on from kind of our evolution as human beings. Why don't you like to sit with your back to the open space? And how do we like to be sheltered in a green space? And how that actually impacts on your heart rate? So it's you know, there's just, we can talk about it for hours and hours and hours on end. But it's what's key, I think, is that we've introduced that into the space and we haven't been prescriptive in a way that, yes, research says that, but, you know, is that true? Is that the reality? So we've tried to seek as much feedback from our members as possible. And it's amazing, but it's consistently people saying, well, I feel really calm. I feel really calm. I feel really composed. I come to work. I come into the building. I get my coffee. I have my 10 minutes when I put my list down. And I just feel kind of zen. And it's nice when you've been in the space and you've done the work. And hopefully, you know, you've done your 9 till 6. And then at 6, you get out of the office and you feel like you've accomplished what you set to accomplish for the day. And that feeling of satisfaction is great. And that's really what we're trying to help our members achieve. And it's very much about focusing on you as an individual. Community is important, but I personally believe the community forms very well when individuals within that community feel well. And that focus on you then impacts on that community feeling altogether. But design is a fascinating tool, really, and how space can be made so attractive or not attractive just by changing some very simple aspects that then can be carried home as well and applied, you know, for everyone and kind of their living rooms and bedrooms and maybe help with their better sleep and, you know, making sure they relax and unwind. And it's phenomenal what can be done.
Tanya, we're really running out of time here. And as you say, we could talk all day about this. There's so much to say here. But I'm just so curious about where you sort of go in the next step from here. You know, you've just opened this flagship property, as we mentioned, and a massive scale. But you're working, it sounds like, on improving the way we work and the way we interact, as well as, you know, trying to grow this business and this market. So where do those meet? And tell me sort of what you're working on these days and going forward.
We're fascinated by the application of technology and space. And it's actually a part of the tech that hasn't really taken off as much as you'd see sort of in, you know, your personal devices. Real estate is very much behind from sort of a tech aspect point of view. And it's not about replacing communication or collaboration of people within the space, but it's actually how they interact with the space themselves to make their day-to-day easier, to navigate through the space simpler, to feel like, you know, they don't need to spend time on unnecessary tasks. And, you know, through technology, through sensor technology, hardware and software together, how do we genuinely take our office spaces and bring them to kind of 21st century? And that's something that we've been sort of looking in and thinking about and, you know, collaborating with various different partners on. It's a long-term project and it's a, you know, very heavy, sort of investment-heavy type of project. But fundamentally, we feel that our sector will be probably the first one that will genuinely bring that to that level, because hotels haven't, and for probably right or wrong reason, but they just have a very different type of user and the length of that user, where we sit in a very different category. And it's fundamentally understanding, you know, how we work, what's the way to work, what's the more efficient way to work, how do we use the space, and how do we help and make our, to be honest, most precious resource, being usually employees of the companies, the most expensive part of any business, to the, you know, top possible performance while they still feel like they're fulfilled and they're happy. So that would certainly be very much a next kind of angle to the business that we'd love to take. But currently it's London expansion, it's European expansion, and it's getting more properties, beautiful properties in the right location that offer that uncommon feeling when you walk in through the front door.
That's all we have time for on today's program. Thank you very much to Tanya Adir, co-founder and CEO of Uncommon, for coming in to share her story. The show was mixed and edited by Mei Lee Evans. I'm Daniel Bache. Thank you so much for listening, and goodbye.